That was definitely the scariest thing I've ever done, because I think that's the thing I wanted most in this life, was to be a writer.
Welcome to the Open Exploration Podcast. I'm on a mission to connect with rule breakers, dream makers, and all-around inspiring people to explore the possibilities for living a vibrant and honest life on my own terms. Hey, everyone. If you've ever said to yourself, oh man, I wish I could be a blank, or I bet I would be really good at blank, then today's episode is for you. I got to talk with local author Heather Mateus Sappenfield about her path to becoming a writer and why, ultimately, it took a big, scary leap to make it happen. Heather's work spans genres. She has published 2 young adult novels, a short story collection, and a middle grade novel, and you can find her work in publications such as The Writer's Chronicle, Writer's Digest, and various other writing journals and outdoor magazines. In our conversation, Heather shares about the inspiration for her characters, how she has dug deep in herself to learn how to stay in a scene beyond the point when it's tidy and comfortable, and the ways that her pursuits as an adventure athlete, including her experience cycling across America with a relay team, have prepared her for the challenges of this career. She also urges us to recognize what we really want and need and believe versus our social conditioning. You can find out more about her work at heathermateussappenfield.com. The link is in the show notes. I was particularly excited to see Heather's recent interviews with the writer George Saunders and poets Kwame Dawes and Chris Abani, so you might want to check out the links to those articles on her website. Now, without further ado, my conversation with the wonderful Heather Mateus Sappenfield. Heather, thank you so much for coming over today to talk about your story. It's really a treat to get to meet you in person.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for inviting me. I'm honored to be here.
Absolutely. One of the things that we talked about before was this idea of success, not as about affluence, but about getting to live your life the way that you want to. And I think that this whole podcast project could be summed up in that phrase, living the way that we want to. Mm-hmm. And especially when it means maybe ignoring some of the rules about how we're supposed to live or how we're supposed to be successful. And so I'm really grateful to get to kind of pick your brain a little bit and get your insight on that.
Oh, thanks. I will try to provide some good insight. They're definitely my insights from my experience. But yeah, perhaps it'll help someone.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, I'd love to hear a little bit about your, just a snapshot of your life in this moment.
Yes. Well, I'm a mountain gal. I live in Vail, and I tend to be very quiet and introverted, as most authors are. But this week I've been down at the Mountains and Plains Independent Booksellers Association meeting, and so I've been very, very social for a few days. A snapshot of my life and why I'm there is that I'm an author. I have 4 books that I've published, 2 young adult novels, and then I had a short story collection release in 2020, September. And a middle grade novel, which released this last February.
One of the sort of warnings we often hear when we want to go into a creative career or when a kid is thinking about a creative path is it's hard to make enough money. You know, you're never going to make it in that field.
Yeah.
And one of sort of the solutions that you've talked about is, okay, if I'm not going to make, you know, tons and tons of money, maybe I can change my lifestyle and shift the way that I live so that that doesn't have to be a limiting factor.
Yeah, I'll never forget when I was studying for my MFA at Pacific University and my mentor, Bonnie Jo Campbell, she actually gave this talk to writers and she said she has quite a sense of humor and a good Midwestern twang. So imagine this. And she's talking. She said, okay, if you really want to be a writer, you need to 1, marry a trust funder, or 2, live in a swamp.
So which did you choose?
Well, neither. But, you know, most writers work really hard and they just barely are making it. They're living from check to check. They may get some royalties on their books, but they do other things to make ends meet. They teach or, you know, they have other jobs or whatever that might be. And so they're writers and something else, writers and teachers or whatever. In my case, I'm lucky. I'm living off my husband, who's a teacher, his big fat salary,
which everyone knows.
But I also teach, and the way that we adjusted our lifestyle was, and I think it's just, it's also partly who we are as people. We live in what would be considered a tiny house, a little log house in Vail. We have 585 square feet. And then my loft upstairs brings it up to just over 600. We have one car and some e-bikes, and we tend to ride our e-bikes most of the summer. My husband rides all winter on his e-bike on his snow tires. And we have a really good life. I would not say that we are poor in any way. We just have made choices that don't fall into what we tend to be so conditioned about what we need, you know, more things, two cars, all that insurance. And we just live simply. And it's actually not much of a sacrifice. And there's another thing that I have found that seems to be a tenet of my life, which is if you're doing the right thing, if you're pursuing the thing in your heart that you know is what you really want, then things tend to fall in place. You know, you think, oh, if I could do this, if this would happen. And it's not sort of like this, you know, worry. It's more of a, this is what I really feel like I should be doing. And you pursue it, and then things fall into place.
Yeah. You made a point when we were talking before that was a real light bulb for me, which is that we in our society tend to associate money with survival, you know, with mm-hmm. being able to make it in this world. And so there's really high emotional value to having enough, to feeling secure, to knowing that you're going to have plenty. And I think that that is a really beautiful idea to be able to pare down, to be able to recognize what are the things that I really need. You know, I'm going to have a roof over my head. I'm going to have food to eat. If I can cover those bases, I'll be okay. I also think as a young person, I'm looking around and seeing the world getting more and more expensive all the time, you know, and I do want to acknowledge how real that fear can be. You know, I sometimes wish that I'd recognize that I wanted to live a healthy, happy life on my own terms, like after 10 years in a very lucrative career or something like that.
So it's really nice and easy and cushy.
Yeah, you build up the bank first and then have your awakening.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, definitely. You know, I will say this. My grandfather, who passed away a few years ago, he was actually the oldest man in America, 111 years old. And I remember he actually came to the United States as a Portuguese immigrant and really faced a lot of prejudice when they first arrived. He and his family first arrived, I mean, to the point where he wouldn't talk about it anymore. And they were so poor, and they were migrant workers, and they were picking oranges in Orange County, California. And he worked very hard throughout his life and became a millionaire. And at one point, I remember him saying to me, you know, now that I have as much money as I could ever want, I can buy any car I want. I can buy any house I want. I can do whatever I want. He said, but it doesn't mean anything because it's so easy. So I think in many ways, the friction is an important aspect of motivating and of finding meaning as well in these things. You know, if you have to, if it's something that it's difficult for you to get and then you achieve it, then sometimes that has more meaning than if you could just afford anything, you know. Mm-hmm. Or if you're making a choice about a life like, you know, that where you aren't going to have a lot of money or you're going to live simply to do the things that you want, it may have more meaning than if you did have a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah. If you are willing to make sacrifices for that thing that you want, or if you're willing to take a real risk.
Yeah, exactly.
Without that cushion. Yeah. Well, I know that you've taken a lot of risks in your career and those have gotten you to where you are. I'd love to back up a little bit and talk about your career and your life before you became a writer, or maybe before you became a writer in the sense that you are now. It sounds like you've always been writing.
I have always been writing. I've been writing since I was a kid and reading a ton since I was a kid. I definitely had a writer's childhood. And, you know, they talk about those, you know, which are challenging or difficult. So, you know, that kind of led me forward. And I left home at 17 and lived out of my car for a while. And so, moving forward, there's always been sort of like this kind of struggle, I guess, that from that point on, maybe everything seemed easier. But I came to writing later in my life, and it took a lot of time and energy to get to the point where I was able to do that thing that I always knew as a kid I was meant to be doing. I ended up graduating from Regis, which is right over here mm-hmm. by you. And I taught high school for a few years, well, 5 years. And then I resigned when my daughter, she's about a year old and really started talking, had the Australian accent of her daycare lady. And I thought, I think I need to stay home with my daughter. And so I did. And I started at that point to actively pursue writing. I would send stories off to magazines, and I had a couple of close moments where I almost got published, and they asked me to revise stories, but it didn't work out in the end. And I realized that I needed to get my master's degree, that I wanted to. It's not for everybody, but I wanted to get that and to learn craft, to really learn craft. And that was definitely the scariest thing I've ever done, because I think that's the thing I wanted most in this life, was to be a writer. You know, I'd always had this idea and this sense that I was supposed to do it. But if I went and, you know, I didn't do well, I would learn that I actually wasn't good enough to be a professional writer in the way that I wanted. I could always write, but maybe I wouldn't be a professional writer.
Yeah, I think there's so much wisdom in that. I think it's so easy to say, you know, well, I could have been a writer, you know, mm-hmm. if I'd gone for it, I know that I would have been really right. successful. But when you actually take that step and start to do the work to get there, you're really seeing what your stuff is.
Exactly.
You're really seeing what you're capable of.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I would say to the people who are thinking, I'd really like to do that, but I'm not trying to do that, you know, stop and look at what the barriers really are. And if you actually are having boundaries within yourself that are holding yourself from trying, you know, are the barriers really that big?
Yeah. Are the barriers your fear of failure or your fear of not being as good as you think?
Yeah. So then I went, and it was fabulous, but also really hard. Turned out I was good enough. And in my third semester, one of my stories won a contest and publication. And then, you know, things just kept moving from there.
Backtracking a little bit, that time when you were staying home with your daughter, you were also working somewhat as a freelance writer.
Yes.
Part-time.
Yeah.
Writing for outdoors magazines, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was writing for home magazines, outdoor magazines, tourism magazines. Yeah, I was doing that, and I was tutoring. I don't think we ate dinner out in a restaurant for like a year. I mean, like we were cutting it close. But it was also a really beautiful time, really fun time.
How does one become a freelance writer? What were you doing during that time to get your work published and to get paid for your craft?
I had been a journalism major actually in college at first, and I switched to English. I struggle a bit with journalism because especially hard journalism, you can really infringe on people's personal space, and there's always a slant, whether mm-hmm. you want to admit it or not. It's your perspective. It's not the perspective of the person you're writing about. So I struggled with that and the invasion of privacy that went on with that, and then switched to teaching English. But when I started writing more for magazines, you know, I had some journalism training, but what I really did was I read the magazines, and then I echoed the style, and I would write a query letter with confidence, and lo and behold, you know, it came together. That said, I didn't shoot for the moon right out of the bucket either. You know, I started low, and I got published in magazines that were, you know, local and smaller, and sometimes those actually pay pretty well. And then I got into the bigger magazines, and then, you know, next thing you know, an editor's talked to another editor, and they're calling you for an article, which is nice.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
So with a query letter, are you proposing a story that you'd like to write about? Or
yes.
Do you have a piece already written?
So you know the magazine, you mm-hmm. know their tone, you know their content, and you write the letter that's tailored to fit what that is. You know, looks like they could use an article about this and it would be a fit. Here's their slant. Here's how they mm-hmm. tend to present it, you know, and if you write toward that, then you have a good chance.
Nice. So if you happen, you know, somebody who's racing or who has an amazing story in the outdoor world or something like that, and you say, you know, mm-hmm. I think this would be a great fit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Well, getting back where we were, when you were in your MFA program, you mentioned that that type of writing was so intense, so deeply personal, mm-hmm. that it was a process that you went to therapy even to be able to write at that level.
Oh, well, you know, I was at Pacific University out of Forest Grove, Oregon. I guess maybe they're now in Portland. Oh boy, you know, some of the best writers in the country were there, and you know, they kept demanding more and more from my stories and saying, oh no, you left the scene too early, they haven't worked things out, you know, and things like that. And you'd be like, okay. But you know, it was really hard to stay in some of these scenes and to watch and to have to work through with the characters. So yes, I literally had to go to therapy and talk, you know, get over my stuff, because I was reining in my characters and not allowing my stories to go where they needed to go. And it's really interesting now, at this point in my career, I'm mentoring other writers and I teach narrative workshops, and I can literally see it in people's, you know, stories when they start hedging it and they start controlling the story instead of letting the characters take the story where it needs to go. And you can, I can even see it often. It's literally there in the way people put words down on the page, sort of the sequencing and the ordering and words they avoid and the way they place language on the page. All of it dances around things that we may not want to face.
Yeah, it's very self-protective.
Mm-hmm, very much so. And so, you know, when you read a really good book, you know, that really draws you in, I think there's an implicit relationship between the reader and the writer where the reader is very much aware of what the writer is pursuing in their work. It may be a story about these characters over here, but along the way, the writer is also doing some interior work. And I think that that's sort of a metafictional experience that we all have. But I think we all know those books where we start and it's just like, wow, it's so good and so good and so good. And then all of a sudden, it slows. What's going on here? Why is it not so interesting anymore? And 9 times out of 10, for me, it's pretty apparent that the writer actually steered away from the momentum of where the story needed to go.
Can you think of examples, maybe back from your time in your MFA program, when you were working on a story or developing a character and you felt sort of a personal block or a personal protectiveness that kept you from writing that the most honestly or the most authentically that you could?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of hard to put a pinpoint because it was literally across all my stories. Mm-hmm. You know, I would leave scenes too soon before people worked it out. And I think for me, that was just, you know, wanting to avoid the conflict of it and not wanting to be there in that moment. I think we all do that to an extent. A lot of us do that to an extent, you know, avoiding the conflict and where that might lead. I studied with Pete Fromm, who's a marvelous writer out of Montana, and he kept saying, you know, you got to stick with it. You ended it too soon. You know, stay with the scene, write it until it's over, maybe passed over, and then condense, you know, cut short what's not, you don't need. And I just remember, like, he was right. Like, when I finally sat down with it, and if I stayed with those characters, they would work. These conversations would come out that were really interesting. I was like, oh, I actually hadn't gotten in deep enough with those characters. They hadn't really seen what they needed to see within themselves. So it was learning patience and investment in them and the patience within myself to let their story unfold. You know, and there's something that's occurring to me right now, which I think I might be a little bit proud of, but my daughter is 23 currently, and she's been on a tear traveling through Europe and much of it alone, and she's so confident. And I think that actually translated into my parenting too, now that I think about it, just allowing the space for her to be who she needed to be too, you know, to grow and to get through what she needed.
And does that mean then allowing your characters or your daughter or the other people in your life to kind of butt up against those moments of conflict that might be scary, or to see what's on the other side of those big conflicts?
Absolutely. You know, that's something I think, you know, the crucible is always an important aspect of change, but we like to try to avoid it. But without that fire and that impetus, it doesn't really happen. So, you know, I think just being willing to put holding our fingers or our toes over the fire or stepping into it and seeing what happens on the other side, it's not comfortable. But yeah, it's an important aspect always.
Yeah. I imagine that is a very personally demanding, emotionally demanding role as a writer, that when you're writing a scenario for a character and thinking about how they would respond, you probably have to go pretty deep in yourself to think about what is going to be a human response to this. What are maybe the ugly things that I'm going to see come up in myself, or what would this character see come up in themselves to be able to work through this?
Yeah, except you're putting a step in there that doesn't exist for me, at least as a writer, which is the character exists and they are their own existence. And so they move along, you know, like literally when I was ending the stories and they were telling me to stay with it, or even now when a character moves along and all of a sudden they're headed towards something that I recognize, I don't want to go there. I just need to step back and write it down. So the character for me has its own life. And my job is not to step in and revise what would be going on, but to stay with the character. So example, my most recent novel, The River Between Hearts, I write from obsessions. I think a lot of us writers do, things we see that stick with us. And a lot of times they settle into our unconscious, but they're there in the back of our minds. And it was something I had seen when I was teaching high school at Battle Mountain in Vail. All of a sudden one day, the main character of The River Between Hearts showed up, just walking along the creek bank, just she was so angry and you know, stomping along. She's 11 years old, almost 11, but also a hoot. You know, she was just making mistakes and was just really, I could tell, was really understandable and approachable. And when I realized the story she wanted to tell, at first I was like, no, I saw this in high school. You're too young to tell this story. But then as her story started to unfold and what was going to go on, and she was showing me what was going to go on, I realized that actually, no, she was the best person in the world to tell the story, because she was doing it from a naive perspective without any politics or any adult understanding or even the teen understanding. And it was really, that was an aha moment for me. Yeah, just allowing the character.
So when a character appears for you, does that mean, you know, you see an 11-year-old physically walking down the creek, stomping in boots, looking angry, and then you kind of get to know what this person's life might look like, what their story maybe would be? Is it based on a real person usually, or is it more like a muse, somebody who kind of pops up in your imagination and you follow that thread?
Someone who pops up. Just someone who pops up in my imagination. And sometimes as they go along, I'll recognize, oh, those are some characteristics from, you know, someone I knew from somewhere. But for the most part, they're their very own people. And they're very much alive in my mind. And I'm sure it's my unconscious working. Often when they first arrive, it's so vivid. I will go sit down and write it. I will write that arrival. And that's often how the book will begin.
How the character appeared to you.
Yeah, because usually they're in the midst of things, and that's a good place to begin the book. Sometimes I back up and ask more, you know, show me what went on beforehand, you know.
So in that book, A River Between Hearts, you write about grief, and you write about what from the adult world we look at as political, but mm-hmm. in the book is very much a human issue of immigration and mm-hmm. who has a right to live where and yeah. what that kind of loss can look like. The character that comes to mind, obviously, is Perla. Mm-hmm. And I know you've talked a little bit about the research that went into writing that character and all mm-hmm. of the cultural nuances around that character.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about the inspiration and yeah. the work that you did to make that character really feel authentic?
I think you've read the book. I love it. So I love writing this is a thing I've realized now, four books in. I love writing about the intersection of people from different cultural backgrounds or socioeconomic backgrounds. I love writing that moment because I think those are always really pivotal telling moments about who we are as people. And our true colors really shine, especially if it happens during a time of stress. And they have the potential to also be some of the most beautiful moments of our lives. So inherent in that is writing about the other culture. And I try to be very, very careful about writing about the other culture. So with this book, I knew I was going to be writing about the immigrant Mexican experience. And some of those students that I had in the classroom, I would walk in the front doors of the school every once in a while in a morning, and a group of the immigrant students, they would all be gathered together crying because someone's parents or maybe several sets of parents had been rounded up the night before and deported, and then they're stuck in America with, you know, no family. So that's what The River Between Hearts addresses, except from the perspective of 10 and 11-year-olds and how they would handle that situation. Some of those students that I had when I was teaching are now adults, and they helped me write the character of Perla. And then one of them, to the extent, you know, it's very much some of the things that happened in her life. And so she is receiving half of the royalties from the book.
How did you come to that decision? You know, as a writer, you, of all people, know how many hours, how much labor, how much work you put into this book. And to honor somebody else's contribution to that level, saying, you know, half of this belongs to you and could only have been created because of you.
Right. Well, that's it exactly. And, you know, I think for me, again, once again, money is not necessarily, I don't hold a relationship to money maybe that a lot of other people do. It just felt ethically that it was the right thing to do, that if I had not had this help, the book wouldn't have worked. So I could put all the time I want into it, but it would not have worked as a book. It made it authentic and correct and true. One thing that she told me toward the end made me cry. Like I was like, oh, I would never have written that. I don't think I could have ever thought of that. And that's completely from true experience.
Yeah. It strikes me too that it kind of connects back to your discomfort when you were a journalism major of kind of owning somebody else's story and saying, I'm going to tell this from my perspective.
Yeah.
That instead you were receiving that as a gift and saying, you know, this is so valuable that you've shared your story with me and trusted me to write it into this character. This book is partly
yours.
You're
probably absolutely right about that. You know, I think that's true. Absolutely.
So I'd love to talk about kind of after you got your MFA and once you had graduated that program, what did that process look like of starting the journey to be a quote unquote real author?
Well, I was very lucky in that my stories, I was getting published. I had one story win a contest, another one was, it was a runner up. I think I was a runner up for a bunch of them. And it started to be pretty, I wouldn't say easy, but it happened with more frequency that I was placing stories in literary journals, which you make virtually no money doing that. You win prize money for their contests, but you don't make much money. But it did build my resume. And so after I graduated from Pacific, I returned to a novel I had drafted before I'd started. And all of a sudden, I could see everything that needed to happen. You know, I'd grown a lot as a writer. And so I revised it, and then I sent it out to agents with that resume. And lo and behold, I had a few agents that were interested in the novel. And I selected one and went with the agent, and she placed it, and the book came out. So it was all pretty quick. It was like, you know, within a year after finishing my master's degree. And I feel really lucky that it all came together.
Yeah, I have a lot of questions from that, but I think first and foremost, I'm thinking about that time frame of a year. Mm-hmm. It is very quick. That is sort of miraculous.
Might have been more like a year and a half. P- publishing is slow. Yeah. Traditional publishing is so slow, like a year to 2 years to have a book come out. Yeah.
Well, my point too is that when you are in that moment in your life, mm-hmm. you know, you've graduated, you sort of have this piece of paper that says like, I'm the real thing. Mm-hmm. But that's a long time to kind of continue building your career, continue supporting your family, continue right. giving yourself the message of this is going to work, this mm-hmm. is happening, be patient.
Yeah. Oh, self-doubt. I think even the most successful authors have imposter syndrome here and there, and self-doubt. It's just there all the time, no matter what. And there's probably a few that aren't like that. Because the writing is so personal, I think that we're constantly questioning ourselves and holding that, you know, personal space.
I can certainly relate to what you're saying too, that voice whenever I'm trying to do something that is really personal, mm-hmm. that creative process.
Yeah.
That there's that voice that says like, oh, that's not good enough, or like, ooh, that's, yeah, so what are you doing?
The self-doubt.
Yes. How do you respond to that voice? How do you work past that and actually have the courage to put something out there?
I put my head down time and time again. And I, you know, I frequently say to my husband, oh, this is really hard. This is hard. I don't know if I, you know, I should just get a job, you know, make life easier for us. And then, you know, I get over it. And that voice, though, I'd encourage anybody who, when I feel that voice and when you feel that voice, usually that voice is not coming from the heart. It's coming from your mind. And it's a conditioned response. It's the doubter. If it is coming from within, that's when, you know, like really deep within you, like an intuition, then that's when you should listen and maybe consider something else. But usually for me, that voice is coming from conditioning I've had socially or experience, you know, things that have gone on in life, and it's not helping anybody.
Yeah, it makes me chuckle because I think there's always that question of like, well, maybe I should just get a job and give a little bit more energy to the other areas of my life that are really bright and happy and meaningful. I happen to know that you have a very full life outside of being an author too, and so much adventure and activity and just a beautiful space around you to explore. So I wonder, I guess I can really see both sides to that. You know, on one hand, it is so meaningful to pursue a career that is really personal, mm-hmm. really challenging,
yeah.
that kind of allows you those opportunities to confront that self-doubt time and time again. And on the other hand, I can sort of see another window of, you know, if the money-making side of things is a little bit less meaningful, a little bit less challenging, a little smoother, does it then open up these other areas of our lives that really matter to us?
Yeah. That money, the whole... Like literally, if there was not, okay, if it was equal money, that's where you can go. Okay, equal money on both sides, what would I do? Mm-hmm. If it was the same on both sides, what would I do? That makes your choice pretty easy, actually, because you can go, oh, well, I would do this. And then you need to consider, all right, well, if I'm looking at there, if there was equal money on both sides and I would do this, then I need to reconsider what my priorities are and how important that money is.
Yeah, that's a really helpful way to look at it, I think. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily measuring this kind of challenging, unexpected, lofty version of events compared to something that's like tried and true and just going to work, but saying, okay, if I think about how do I want to spend my days, all things considered equal, what's the answer to that question?
Yeah, I believe actually time is the great commerce. What are we willing to give our time to? That seems even more important than money to people right now. And so how do you want to spend your time? Who do you want to spend your time with? You know, how do you want to spend your life? And especially coming off of COVID, people seem very, very aware of that and have been sort of housekeeping aside the things that they realized were not fulfilling for them, you know, or maybe, you know, everybody's quitting jobs and starting new jobs because I don't want to spend my time and my life that way. So it's really interesting to think about that. And I agree, you know, time I think is our ultimate currency. And how do you want to spend your time? the time that you have here? Do you want to be, you know, for a lot of people, just a regular job in an office, that's great. And then they don't have to worry about anything else, and they can have hobbies and careers, and that's me, and it's absolutely fine. But then there are some people who really want to strive toward other things and find that meaning. And that's where you really have to look at your priorities and look at what your conditioned way of thinking is and your conditioned ways of behaving, where you learned your ideas of success and comfort, and recognize if maybe they're just conditioned. You know, we're so conditioned. We're so conditioned even in how we allow ourselves to dream. Like from the moment we're born, the conditioning begins, right? And so look at all of that and recognize, oh, okay, I'm limiting myself just because I'm used to thinking that way versus, oh, I could do this. And this is really what I want.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking about listening to a deeper, more intuitive sense of what's true for us.
Yeah.
Do you have a personal process or a way of tapping into that voice and differentiating between the conditioning and what's really true?
It's the constant work, right? I think that what's important, you know, they talk about meditation or just being in quiet stillness and just allowing yourself the space to just sit for a minute, you know, to turn off the TV and the music and everything else and maybe just be for a minute and to be in your body. And then within your body, maybe feel the sensations within your body, and then pull back a little bit and recognize the part of you that's observing the sensations. That part of you that's observing the sensations is your inner self. And if you can be with that inner self and just rest there, that allows you some space to really look at how your mind might be working.
Yeah. I think what first pops to mind is that's not easy. You know, it's a lot easier to be distracted or to kind of turn away from the really negative feelings or the feelings of, I guess for me currently, it's that feeling of like, what if I'm totally lost? So that takes a lot of courage too.
Yeah. But being totally lost is not a bad thing. Right? And I think being lost is part of the journey to finally ending up where you're going to go.
Yeah. Well, on that topic of sort of ending up where you're headed, I guess, one of the phrases that I think about a lot is this idea of quote unquote making it. And it's, I don't know if I necessarily believe in that concept, you know, of finally checking the one big box and saying I've done it. But I do think it's maybe really valuable at times to reflect on those achievements that we at one point wouldn't have thought were possible. I'd love to hear about some times in your career and your life that you've had those moments of getting to reflect and thinking, wow, I did not know I could make it here.
Well, you know what's so funny? So I live in Vail, right? And we make Olympic athletes. That's what we do up there, right? So sometimes when I tell people I'm a writer, they say, oh, what kind of bike are you on? You know?
Oh, I say, no, writer.
Right, no, I say writer. And I have been a writer too on the bike. But my point being that the good thing about my community is they always keep it, they keep me in perspective. Like, I'm just Heather, you know, their friend that they've been riding bikes with forever. And, you know, this, my success in riding has come a little later in life. And so that always helps. But I have had some aha moments come along. When my mentor, Bonnie Jo Campbell, was here with her last novel, I drove her around and, you know, in Boulder and to some of her appearances. And then
when
she came
was
up
this?
For a visit. Oh, gosh. I think it's about 7 years ago now. And I took her to a radio interview at KGNU Radio in Boulder. They do this literary interview. And I waited outside in my car while she went in and did the interview. And at that point, I hadn't really made it yet, making it, so to speak. And I remember thinking, someday I want to be an author worthy of an interview on this radio station. And sure enough, this last winter, they invited me down and we did our interview and it was fantastic. And they took my picture out front, you know, for the, to post about the pod or the interview. And I walked out of there and I thought, oh, this is, I need to hold on to this moment because this is one of those milestones, right? Where I've come along far enough and wow, that was cool.
I imagine too, when you first thought of that, you know, sitting in your car waiting for an hour for your mentor to come back out, there's plenty of time to think like, oh, someday I'd like to be well, but that, you know, that can't, maybe the doubts roll in or, you know, there's reasons why. So what a cool moment.
It was a really fun moment.
You've also gotten to walk a red carpet.
I did. Thank you. You know, this last couple of years, it's been crazy. But yes, my short story collection, Lyrics for Rockstars, the fabulous Michael Crouch, who is one of the best audiobook narrators, he agreed to do my audiobook from this little publisher. And in the stories, there's 17 stories, only three of them are men. And the ages range from an 8-year-old girl to a 103-year-old man. And he does them all. Like, I cried, I laughed. I mean, he is unbelievable. It's a tour de force. And so his performance, I mean, in audiobook narration, there's the equivalent of the Academy Awards and the Grammys. So there's the Sovis Awards and there's the Audies. And he won the Sovis. And we were finalists for the Audies. And it was just quite an experience. It was really fun.
Wow. So to put it in perspective, you're in the same room with Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Mm-hmm. Barack Obama, Sam Heughan, Gavin McTavish. Yeah, which is, yeah, really cool stuff.
Wow. That sounds like such a sort of a surreal moment.
Imposter syndrome moment, yes. I think it was funny. My husband, bless his bones, he's so supportive of me being a writer, but he was like, oh, wow.
I didn't realize.
Oh, that's great.
How did you get connected with Michael Crouch?
Well, my publisher at V Press LC, she said, send me some samples of your favorite narrators that you think would be good. And we'll, you know, we'll try to find someone like that, right? Like a similar style. And she just emailed him directly. And I was like, go, girl. And he agreed. And we're friends now. And he's just fabulous.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. So sort of a shot in the dark by your publisher and came to fruition.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a big kind heart.
That is so cool. Well, you sort of alluded to this before, but you are definitely an athlete in your own right as well. One of sort of the achievements that pops up when, you know, if somebody Googled you is that you have cycled across America in the race across America.
Yeah.
What was that experience like? Or maybe other kind of adventures like that?
That experience was nutty. I mean, it was a rolling circus. You know, never stopped a relay race from San Diego to Atlantic City that year. The course changes every year, but I believe our four-woman team still has the record for the fastest crossing. And it was just mayhem. I mean, we had, I want to say, 12 crew, an RV, and two chase vehicles. And so it was, and we were constantly out, constantly, you know, a relay race. So it was chaos. I remember riding across, I think it was New Mexico. There was an incredible sunset just lighting the sky, but I was so tired and I had been so sick. And, you know, just, I learned that at one point I was just going to be thrown up for a little while because we were pushing ourselves so hard. And I was just hallucinating that I was with my daughter, who at the time was about 5, and that she was on the bike with me and it was going to get me through. I remember that really well, and how sometimes imaging like that can carry you through. You know, it's funny. I think the writer's life is very difficult. You're just very solitary, and and at the computer all the time. And I sort of feel like all these things in life prepared me for the writer's life when it finally arrived. You know, it can't get much harder than that or that or that. Stay with yourself.
Yeah.
You know, don't have that self-doubt. You can do it. You can do it. Yeah.
Yeah. You kind of built that muscle, that capacity to be able to suffer,
mm-hmm.
to be able to feel really, really deep mm-hmm. doubt and despair and
mm-hmm. and persevere.
And persevere.
Perseverance, I think. And I think that's just one of the themes. If you're going to pursue a life that is unique like that, you know, that is that dream, perseverance is pretty important.
So your aim is not comfort?
Comfort's okay here and there. I think it's pretty unhealthy to always seek comfort. How's that?
Yeah.
If I'm constantly comfortable, then I know maybe it's time to do something that helps me grow.
Maybe you're missing out on an adventure somewhere.
Yes, exactly. I love a good adventure.
Well, speaking of adventures, you are currently in the process of writing a new book.
I am. Yeah, that one's about 200 pages in. I need to finish drafting that. I've just finished, I'm going to be seeking publication for a humorous women's fiction novel that actually is based partly on my grandmother. But then this new novel I'm drafting, yeah, I love writing humor. I think, you know, if you can keep a good dose of humor through the tough times, that's always healthy. Actually, I love going between humor and tears, you know, the poignancy and the juxtaposition of those. But this novel really looks at how we view our norms and how we view aging and death. We are so afraid of both in our American culture, to my eye. And so it very much looks at what life really means and how we live our lives, and then how that, you know, what fears do we live with, and why do we push aging aside? Why do we push our aged aside? And also death.
Wow, that sounds beautiful. I'm excited to read it.
Me too. That one's been one where I've had to stick with my character. It's just been, really? This is what we're doing right now? Wow. Okay, let's go there. Let's try it.
Yeah. That's a cool process. We talked a minute ago about sort of those aha moments of look where I'm at. I wonder if you have moments looking forward, kind of like that one in the parking lot in Boulder, when you think, you know, I'd really like to make this happen, or this is a goal for, or a vision for the coming years.
For me, part of having been a writer is always striving toward that dream. And writing is so competitive. You know, getting things out, getting the agent, getting published, all of that is so competitive that I think I'd like to find a space of more, a little bit more contentment. Not, you know, still growing, still learning, but being a little bit more content within that space. And perhaps saying, yeah, okay, you're doing a good job. You've made it this far. A little bit more self-love, perhaps.
I think that's such a beautiful and kind of a rare goal to hear expressed. It's not about striving for more, 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 or higher, higher, higher necessarily. There, mm-hmm. you know, like there's openness to those possibilities, but it's more about how is this going to feel when I'm doing this thing that I love doing.
Yeah, yeah. Perceiving actually that I'm already there, and the strength that that brings. And I think I have found that my perception has shifted a bit, and as it has shifted to how I'm already there, this is already my life, then things have started to fall into place even more. So it's believing that you are that thing that you want to be in your dream.
Well, that's a beautiful place to end.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Heather, for your time and for sharing your story. It means a lot to me personally, and I'm really excited to share it.
Thank you. I admire your podcast and what you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Open Exploration Podcast. For more about Heather's work, check out heathermateussappenfield.com. You can find the link and the titles of her books in the show notes. This podcast is produced by me, Lily Worthen. Thank you to Poddington Bear, John Sibb, and the other unlisted artists for sharing your music that brings this podcast to life. And to all of you listening, thank you. Love to you all, and until next time, happy exploring.